Welcome everyone to the June 1st Masterclass, 2023 Masterclass. I was running a little behind, but we are here now and we are set. We do have definitely quite a few presenters tonight, but we will start with Ashish.
Yeah, thank you, Marjorie. And
take it
thank
away.
You, everyone. Mm-hmm. Sure, let me share my screen. Please let me know if you can see my screen.
Yes,
looks great.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Good evening, all. This is my second masterclass, and I'm going to talk about Python. It's like a basics of the Python, how to get it installed, how you can, what are the main ingredients of Python that you need to kind of focus on, and how we can write a code in Python. What are the IDEs, like integrated development environment, that are more popular in this Python. All right, so before getting into Python, this is very basic concept, like how any computer program works. So as we know, a computer has processor, like a Intel, AMD, etc., and then there is a memory. And the code that we write, we use like some IDE, integrated development environment, like a Visual Studio Code or any like Eclipse or whatever are available there. And we write a code, that's our source code. But that source code is like only user can understand. I mean, machine can't understand that code, or the processor can't understand it. So it needs to convert into some format which a processor can understand and then execute it. So that's how that's where the compiler comes into picture. Compiler is nothing but it's a software written which takes your source code and convert into a machine code which processor can understand and then execute. And that's how we see the program is executed successfully. This machine code is a set of instructions which is basically in binary format, like a ones and zeros only. The processor fetches these instructions from the memory and executes those instructions step by step. And this is how we see the code is executed successfully. Now, what is Python? Python, as we know, it's a development language. We call it like an interpreted language even though it says like it's just an interpreter, there is a compiler inside which compiles it first, and then it passes it to the Python virtual machine, which converts it into a machine code. So that's why there are two steps integrated here, and that's why it's an interpreter language. It uses object-oriented programming concept. It's a high-level programming language. It is developed by Guido van Rossum in 1991. And since this language is easily, the syntax-wise, readability-wise, it's a very user-friendly language. So it has a reputation like it's a very beginner-friendly language. It uses for server-side development, automation scripting, creating web applications, building workflows, connecting to the database system, and data analytics. As we know, like Python is heavily used in data analytics. And since it's open source, there are lots of supporting libraries available for this language. Now, how Python executes the code? As I said, it's an interpreter language. So what is interpreter now? Interpreter is a software which executes source code line by line. And this is how it happens inside when we write a code and then when we execute it. This is how it happens. So this is an editor, Visual Studio Code editor, where you write your program. That gives you like your source file, which user can easily understand. Then this is the main machine where it gets entered. So there is a compiler, even though it says it's the interpreter language, but there is a compiler. I was always confused with this, how it kind of compiles the code. So there is a compiler for that. But this compiler converts the source code into a bytecode. Again, this is kind of a machine, not exactly machine code. This is intermediate level code. Then this bytecode gets feed into your Python virtual machine. This is a software. We get it like when we install a Python software. So it has like a different libraries. So this bytecode gets fed into virtual machine, and then virtual machine converts into an actual machine code, which a processor can understand and then executes it. Now, how to install Python, and there are plenty IDs available for this, but I will just talk about Visual Studio Code today. So very first thing is like, it's a free software. You can just go over here on the Python. Sorry, let me share my screen here. Yeah, this is how it opens. So Python, there are plenty options available. Like if you are doing development on Windows, so this is how you should download 3.1.1.3. That is the latest. There is a Linux, Mac version, and there are some other OS supporting languages available. Okay, and there is one thing that we need to make sure while installing. So the first thing is like you just download that software, and second thing, you run that executable file. When you run it, this kind of window pops up, and this is like a by default it gives you, but you can customize where you want to kind of install your setup, so that every time you want to go there, you can easily find it, because the machine generator path is sometimes like a very long path, but I prefer like this customization, just like a C, some software, and then just install Python over there. Very important step, this add Python exe to path, we need to make sure this box is checked in while installing it, because so when we execute any Python program, it go and find some dependent libraries and executable files. But if this path is not added to your environment, like a window, I'm talking from the Windows point of view, so Windows environment, then it won't detect it, and it will throw some error. So it's better when you install it, you need to be cautious about this thing, and this should be checked in. The integrated development environment, Visual Studio Code, it's from the Microsoft, and it's a free editor. It supports any language, and this is the kind of page that I have seen so far. So you go here, you download it for Windows or whatever operating system you are using, and then just you get it like that executable file, and you just run it executable file, and it install it on the specific path where you want to install it. And now this is how your Python and integrated development environment is ready. There is a PyCharm also. It's also free, but you need to get the community edition for that. Okay. So for this, I will open my editor. Okay. So any program you write in this integrated Visual Studio Code environment, and as I said, like, I mean, this is like a very user-friendly language. You can easily write a code. As you move up, like with some like object-oriented kind of concept, it gets a little bit trickier. But the initial start of the Python is very easy. Like it's just like you start writing, like, okay, as most of us know, like, I mean, print, right? So what it does, it just kind of displays the whatever you write here on your Windows. So now, once you write some program here, you need to debug it sometimes, and how you can debug it. So this IDE provides a very user-friendly options. This is kind of a run and debug option. You go here, and right now it's set up for me, but when you first time clicks, it will come up with some message like, okay, do you want to set up your IDE and a debugger? So you have to just click on that, and it gives you this file. It's a JSON file, a JavaScript file. This is the file which supports you like when you debug any code in this IDE. The only thing that I want to kind of explain here, like these two lines are not available sometimes in this. It is in my presentation also here. So I mentioned like added, and this one also like a true, just my code. So it says like, okay, I just want to run the code that I'm kind of putting a debugger, the breakpoint and starting to run it. So this gives the idea on that. So Python has several inbuilt functions, like as we know, like a print. Print is to display the results on the screen. Input is the function which accepts the value from the user. Then there are I'm covering like a little bit of Python. There are plenty options available there under the function as well as operators. Arithmetic operator, like your addition, subtraction, equal. Then comparison operator like greater than equal to, less than equal to, not equal to. And the comparison operator and the logical operator returns the Boolean value, and that is like a true and false value. Data types, there are several data types, and the basic data types in Python are integer, your Boolean, then strings. And these are the basic data types, and list is a complex data type. And this is the program that I just wanted to kind of go over while presenting. List. So yeah, list is a mutable. When I say mutable, that means you can alter it on the go. Because as I said, like a string is another database. Say example, you write some string like a name equal to Ashish. So when you access this name and you try to alter this string, it won't allow you. You can just access it and kind of perform the operations on it, but you can't alter it. Whereas your list is mutable, like you, if you want to add something in between, like after, like, so yeah, again, list starts with the zero index. This is the Ashish name is at the zero index, then it's one, then two, something like that. And if you add something, just you have to access that list and put that index. Say example, if you want to add something at number three, because it starts with the zero, so this is two and this is three afterwards. So you just put like a three and then give it something like some name or whatever value you want to put there in under the list. I was talking about the JSON file. I will show you how that file helps. Now, if I want to see how this program is executing, I'll go with the very basic program. Otherwise, okay. Again, in the terminal, I wanted to show this. There are plenty options here, which terminal you want to kind of execute the program. Somebody might like PowerShell, somebody like command, not like your Windows traditional command prompt. There is a Git bash also. I mainly use Git bash. So now if you want to run this program, what you have to do, you have to just put Python. So what is this Python? This is the interpreter actually. So this takes whatever you write after this, like a list, and then you have to feed the file name here, list.py, and when you say enter, it executes whatever is written here, and it gives you the nice display here. So as I said, like you see name, there are three names, and we are just printing these three names. So it just like whatever you declare here, it's getting printed here. Now you see the second, we have declared several numbers in a list, and now print. What I want to print? Just print number two in numbers, in this numbers. But since so it comes here and it doesn't see this number here two in the list, and that's why it's giving you message false here, because it's a binary again. Sorry, it's a Boolean, so true and false. Print length, again, I will start with the debugger. So Okay, wherever you want to start your debugging from, just give this breakpoint, go on this side corner of it and just put this, just click here. It starts, it put that breakpoint there. And then you go here and start debugging, or just press F5 on your computer. And this is how it starts now. And why it's stopping here, because if you see, this is the customized thing that I did, stop on entry. So wherever I'm putting that breakpoint, I'm asking them like a stop there. Okay, so it starts there. Then you press, then there is a, either you press here, this one, because you want to step into, if you want to kind of move up like a step out, this is the command shift. But okay, we'll go like one by one. So we declare this list. There are three names in it. Name starts with zero. Now we came on the print function, which is the inbuilt function of Python. Now we are going on the next one. Okay. So if you see here, it printed like these three names because this function says so. Now number is just reading this list, so it will not print anything, but it came here. It says, okay, print two in numbers in this list, numbers list. Now, when we move on over here, like a step into, you will see false because it did not find two in this number list. Now I'm asking here like, okay, I want to see length of this list. So there's a function for that, print, and then just say length. This is like an inbuilt function. So it gives you like four. So why four? 1, 2, 3, 4. So there are four elements in it. So number, now you want to append something into this list. So how you can do that? Just put like get that list name, put dot, and then append function. And what you want to append? I just want to append like, say, example, 11 number here. So now if you go next, it will print. Now I'm asking like, okay, can you print the number? So now you will see there will be one more number into this added into the list. So it's append at the end of the list. So 1, 5, 6, 8, and this 9. It did not change because I was in the debugger mode. So it just took the previous number. It was 9 here before. Now, I want to insert number 10 at the index 1. So as I said, like it starts with the zero index, and so wherever you're seeing 5, the 10 will get there now. Now print it. So you see that 5 move to the next index, and then as I said, like on index 1, I want to get like a number 10. So it's kind of updated this list accordingly. Numbers, again, the list, and then a remove function. I want to remove some of the element of this list. So I'm saying remove 6. As there is a 6 number, it will remove it, and it will be again like 1, 10, 5, 8, and 9. So you don't, if you see here, you won't be able to see like number 6 as we removed it. Now, clear function, what it does, it clears out the list. It will print nothing here, just a list symbol. So it's a square bracket. So this is how list work. And as we see, like, I mean, it's very easy. Like, I mean, it's like our daily routine words like that we use, like, okay, I want to insert something into the list. I want to remove something from the list. I want to clear the list. Now I want to append the list. So that's why they say it's like a user-friendly language. Next, so we need to make sure like every time we write some program, it should not get into that memory overrun. So now we have this program. I declare one variable I as 1, and I'm going through the while loop here. What it does, it just check, okay, I's value is 1. It's checking this operator is less than or equal to 5. Yes, it is less than or equal to 5. So it will come here and it will print that number. So let me get into the editor. Okay, so we can create new file actually. File test.py. Okay, so I equal to one. While I is, I'm checking here, while I is less than, say example, five, and there's a colon, some syntax we need to learn in Python. And what I'm doing here, I'm printing now I, and I'm going to put debugger here. And in here, I'm just clear out the command so that we can see the nice clear editor terminal. Sorry. Okay. To run the program, just press F5, or you can just go here, run, and you start debugging. Okay. So you read that. Okay. I's value is one. You can see it here also. Local variables, I equal to one. Now you go next. It's the condition is true. That's why it's getting in, and it's going to print whatever value of that Y is. So it's going to print it. It came on the while loop again. Okay. Now what happened? I's value is still one because we didn't do anything on that I. So it is going to print it. So what will happen with this program? It will continuously run until your computer runs out of the memory. So this is how the testing comes into picture. So if you wanna stop this loop, you need to put some condition, and that condition will be like here. We need to increment I so that I can reach to the either five or and then it stops executing that program. So I equal to I plus one. And to comment in Python, you can just put hash in front. Sorry, Visual Studio Code, you can just put. So this can be written as, if you're on a, like this also, it's kind of a abbreviated form of it, what we wrote here. Okay, so now we'll run this code again. We come here, clear it out, and execute the program. Okay, it came on the first one. I's value is one. That is correct. Okay, it's printing I. Now it's getting into this and it's saying, okay, increment the value by one. So now if you see here, I's value is two. So it's checking, okay, I two is less than equal to, okay, yes, it will print again. Now three, now four, and now five. It will still run because we said less than or equal to five. But now I's value here is getting six, and this is where the program will exit. So you see, like, it printed just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and after that it exited the program. So we need to be cautious avoiding such errors here with Python. I have some programs written and I wanted to just kind of go over those so that we get the idea how different inbuilt functions as well as the for loop and the loops works in Python. So this program says, okay, I want to kind of just, so this is the string that we are passing to this function initials. This is the function, how we write function in Python. We need to def, then functions. And this is the our driver code. This is driver code. Okay, so when we start the program again, just give the breakpoint where you want to give the breakpoint. Okay, it stops on that breakpoint because we set up that JSON file accordingly. Okay, so what it does now, it's saying, okay, print. This is the inbuilt function. And this is the return function, like a defined function here. It says, pass this string to this function. So when it will come here, the control will go after this because it's calling this function. This is the call function. This is the call function. So from here, the control will go here because we're calling it. And what string that it pass, universal serial bus. So if you just put your cursor on it, it will show what value you pass to this function variables. So it's universal serial bus. Now you can perform multiple operations on this string. So phrase is the string that you pass here. Now what I'm doing here with the upper, I'm converting the entire this string into the capital letters, and then I'm splitting into on the space. Dot split does it like a split on the space. You see that there is a space in between. So we'll go here, and once I'm step into this, and if I take cursor on the word, it shows me, or we can see it here also. So you knew it's split into three indexes, like a universal, serial, and then bus. Here I declare just one variable, results, where I'm going to save my result. Now this is the for loop. So what it does, it kind of iterate through this word variable, and it extracts out each word out of it. So when I say for, give me the word out of these total words, because total words are like there are three words, like universal, serial, and bus. So what I'm asking with this for loop, give me a word, like the very first word from these three out of this list. Not list, actually, it's a variable. Now, if you go step into here, you will see. So what it does here, okay, it's getting universal. Let's see what's happening here. Okay. Okay, so it ran. So what it did, okay, it got the first word like universal. Then it came here. It came here and it just kind of extracting the word. So this is the kind of a structure of a string, how you can concat, how you can alter the string. So it's asking, okay, start the string from the zeroth index and then go up to the index one. So when in the list, when we say one, so it doesn't kind of go up to the one. So it, in actual, if you see like universal word, so it starts with zero and this is the one. But when we provide in the list, I need to go until one, it doesn't go until one, just kind of it stops just before the order number we put here. And that's why it's just giving us here like a U. In the second iteration, it's taking this serial string, and same thing happening. It's just taking this yes out of it. In the third iteration, it's just taking this bus out of this word. And then just with this line is just getting this B out of it and putting into the previous results. So we are saving the results one by one. Like we save U, then we save like okay, then we say yes and then B. So when we come here, so if you see, it printed USB. Same thing happened with the second. So it came on print initials. Now we are passing local area network. So LAN, we are expecting here LAN. So if we run this code, LAN is there. And you see that we pass like a small case letter, but it converted to LAN in capital because of this function upper. This is one program that I wanted to explain. Second is okay. Yeah, factorial program. We kind of run into this program several times. So this is how. Okay, this is like a proper way of writing a Python program. In C, as we know, like in C, we have like a main function. So this is how the driver code. This is our driver code in Python. Again, it's a syntax. We need to just kind of practice a few times, and then we get into it. So it starts with the name, and this is the main. Every time you run the program, your program starts from here. Now, what we're doing here, we are asking user to give us some value. Enter a number to calculate factorial of something. So I'll put a breakpoint here. So anything that we get as a part of input function, inbuilt function, this is like a scanf in C, if you are familiar with the C. So it's taking the values from the user. So whatever value it takes in the form of string. And since we are performing the factorial on a number, we need to convert that. It's like a typecasting. We need to convert it into an integer. So this is what I'm doing here. I read a value from the user. If I go on like a next, enter, if you see here in the terminal window, enter a number to calculate factorial. So if I want to calculate factorial of 4, I will just enter that number there. And this integer is converting that number into an integer. Let me check it actually. What's up? Okay. Enter number two. Okay. I don't know why it did not go first time. So it come here, it checks. Okay, number is greater than or equal to minus one. Yes, it is. So it comes here, print. And now this is just we calling this fact function from here. So it will bonk, it will go here, it will jump here. Now it's just check. So this is called like a boundary condition analysis. Because sometimes if we pass some negative number, it might messes up the program or it might go into the memory overrun. And that's why these kind of conditions we need to provide, like if the number is less than zero, is it no? Else if, this is how we write else if in Python. Number is equal to zero or number is equal to one, no. Then it will go into else, and this is where the actual that factorial is working on. So it gets here, n is two. So you see that factorial here, so it's again calling the same function again. So it's like a recursive function. This is the example of recursive function, is calling the function within the function, and it will continue until it ends, like the conditions. Okay. So factorial of two is two. Two into one is two. We can. Okay, I guess this program, I did not write it correctly, but yeah, I mean, this is how the execution of the program works and how we can debug the code in the Python. And this is very user-friendly language. These are my references. I mean, just to mention this after nerd, I mean, if you really want to understand what happens within the Python and any computer things, this is like a very, very good link. I mean, I just found this while working on this Python presentation. And thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. I had always wondered how you're supposed to write Python, because I was told all you got to do is write, print and whatever, and it would print it. And I'm thinking, it can't be that easy. And yes, you have to have something like this to put your code into. So that makes perfect sense now. Because even my kid was telling me a couple years back, he was like, Python's easy. I'm like, okay, it does. Yeah, I can see the language.
It is easy, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really looks like the old basic language almost, you know?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Very close to it. Excellent. Very good job. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Olga.
Right. Now let's go with. Okay. We have a lot of people to go through, so I want to make sure that we go as quick as possible. And everybody should be 15 minutes long, so we want to keep that going. We have Gene next. Are you ready, Gene?
Yes. Yes, I'm ready. Good evening, everyone.
Take it over.
Yes. Okay, let me share my screen. This is basically talking about the disaster planning. We're gonna be, a lot of us, we're in this IT field, whether it's software development, whether it's networking development, networking maintenance, network security, software engineering.
Do you have your presentation up yet?
Yeah, can y'all see it?
No.
Really? Hold on. I click share, right?
You click share and then you choose the window you want to share.
Okay, let me click share again. Share. Okay, let's see, window. Give me one second. Hold on. Let's see. I want to share the. Okay, click on share.
It will show you some small windows of what you have open. And you just pick one of those small windows, the small boxes.
Okay, I see it here. Hold on. Give me one second right here. I see. Okay. Can y'all see it?
Yes. I see your PowerPoint. Yep.
Yeah. Disaster planning. Basically. This is basically talking about business continuity and disaster recovery. And I'm gonna keep it. I could have went with much longer, but I'll keep it within the specified time or less since we started late.
Bad. Sorry.
Yeah. No. Thank you.
I
don't want to, because I know the time is running. People have things. So I'll keep it a little less than 15 minutes. So a lot of things we do has to be backed up and stored somewhere, either it's on CDs or some solid state drives, network attached storage. Right now it's the cloud. It's a very big thing, and it's gaining a lot of traction, tremendous traction is the cloud, and it's going to grow bigger and bigger. And we have some very notable. The cloud is just general for online programming, online infrastructure. You could use infrastructure as a service, software as a service, online storage, testing. You could do many things on the cloud. But this is not a presentation on the cloud, so to speak. But because we're dealing with disaster planning, business continuity, and disaster recovery, I had to mention the cloud in this. How it interplays. Now, these things have to be planned very, very well. It has to be planned very well. like we're going to, let me click on the next, or oh, my screen kind of froze here. Give me 1 second. I had to modify this. Okay, right here where it says business continuity plan, and I'm gonna read this here. It says this plan exists just in case we have a massive interruption to the continuation of business. In such a case, the business must be able to continue operation or else face possible extinction. Meaning, when you're running a business, and unless it's for free, you're not really gaining profits or anything, you have to have a business continuity plan. And you need to work not just with the IT side, how you're going to get the flow of operations going and everything, but you also need to work with the business side and the financial side, the accounting, the human resources, just like what somebody presented the other day, like all the departments of the business have to meet to present, to go over some operations and to go over some situations and emergencies if they were to happen. Likewise, the IT department, the accounting, the human resources, the business, you all of them must meet. And like the recording that we had the other day, all of them on all hands on deck meeting, all of them, those departments must meet, or quantum team, to have some type of common ground as to how they would continue the business if everything were to go down. It's extremely important. Why? Because it's been shown that for every hour or a minute or whatever, there's still a lot of statistics regarding this, the business is down, you're losing money. Anywhere from thousands to hundreds of thousands, could even be millions of dollars. So you must have a business continuity plan just in case things go on and things go down. Now, the disaster recovery plan, and I'm going to read this here for you before I give some more explanations. It says, this is a plan that is in formal documentation, which contains detailed instructions on how to deal with major disruptive events, such as cyber attacks. Yeah, we've had cyber attacks, natural disasters, and power outages. Unfortunately, despite having a business continuity plan, sometimes things happen because there are always unforeseen circumstances where something happens beyond what you prepared for. Some system go down that's necessary for, in some way and somehow, and if necessary for the continuation of some aspect of the business, and that might be affected, you have to know how to deal with that. If you don't have a plan, or if something is not like foreseen, you didn't expect it, you have to have a quick impromptu disaster recovery plan. It's very essential to keep your business going, especially when it comes to cyber attacks. Natural disasters, those things happen. Power outages, mostly it's power outages, and or something happened to the building, and you know, people could you know, kind of relocate, work online until, or at home until they come back. But anything like a cyber attack that definitely damages software or steals data, and then that it gets leaked out in the public, this happened and this and that, your reputation is going to take a hit. So you have to have a plan to deal with that. Also, it may get into some legal aspects, which I will mention later. It says here, the business continuity plan will incorporate the services of the disaster recovery plan. The recovery plan will identify and implement steps for critical business functions and recovery. And well, let's look at some of the points of business continuity. You need to determine how those risks will affect the operation, any business you're working on. Like, for example, you're working on something dealing with sales. You know that's going to affect your income. So you have to have everything that we're going to go through in play on a background ready to implement. If it's something critical that you're dealing with, like a hospital, nursing home, medical centers, that is life and death. Yeah, these plans has to be something that's continually, like we would say, quantum team, over and over, continual business meeting, all departments meeting, whether it's every quarter, every month, bi-monthly, or whatever. Always a part of your operations have to be taken into account, a business continuity plan in detail. So you got to determine how those risks will affect your operation. You got to implement safeguards and procedures to mitigate the risks. This is the next thing here, which, and I have seen this, which this is a slack on. Schools and stuff, we don't work in the school, a lot of slack. Testing procedures to ensure that they work. A lot of businesses, where small, medium-sized, large schools, hospitals, when it comes to testing, it's something that a lot of businesses just don't want to be bothered with because they feel like it affects their flow of operation, or it's going to affect their income, or it's going to slow things down. But it is something, and I'm going to say it is necessary. I'm not an expert in business continuity, but I've partaken some of the jobs that I've worked in. I've partaken in some of these plans, and I wasn't the lead or anything, but if people are reluctant to say, okay, let's step aside and let's test to see. Let's run some simulations. Let's run some scenarios. We're going to take this day. That's a dread thing and that these businesses don't want to do. But what will force them to wake up is if something happens critically and they get affected financially, or people's lives are on the risk, or they face legal trouble, which all three is not good. Reviewing the process to make sure that it is up to date. Okay, next point here. Organization, the team comes up with a plan to manage disruption. You must come up with a plan. And of course, when you have your meetings, this is when you are looking at your plans. Recovery, steps are in place to implement critical recovery business functions. Now, the business impact analysis portion is the identification of functions and related resources that are time sensitive. You have to identify the functions and related resources that are time sensitive. You have to do this because if you don't, you miss something. You restore the operation and you think you're restored, and then something happens, you go back down, maybe not totally, but partly. Could lead to a lot of frustrations, loss of money, loss of sales, possibly loss of lives, which, you know, work in a hospital, you don't want to have to deal with that. There was a case in Florida here with the nursing homes where something happened with the hurricane came through. Power was out in this nursing home and 11 people died. And that nursing home faced some massive suits. This team must test and train through exercise, or in other words, they must be thoroughly tested and trained through exercises. That's the only way. You got to exercise, exercise. And I'm going to read this. Step one, outline major goals of the disaster recovery plan. Step two, list and record data personnel. You must. Step three, list all software applications, especially the critical ones. Step four, list the manufacturer, model, serial number, cost, and whether each item is owned, leased for inventory. You must have that. Step five, information services, backup procedures. And now you're going to, this is when you're getting ready for any discovery. This is where the backup comes in. But with recovery, this is where you're going to restore stuff from backup. So you have to have that, whether it's online, whether it's through AWS, Microsoft, Amazon Web Services, whether it's through Microsoft Online Services, Google Backup, you have to have everything detailed. Every department must have all their contact points. Everything has to be detailed. No strings could be left untied or anything, just stone left unturned. Everything has got to be checked. Let's go to the next. Let's go to number 8. Step 6, continuing disaster recovery procedures. You got to have emergency response procedures, backup operation procedures, recovery action procedures. All of that has to be ready when the disaster strikes. Step 7, mobile site disaster recovery procedure. What will you do if you can't meet your particular place is impacted, power is down, generator is down, or some threat or whatever? Do you have a mobile site? Can you operate mobile-wise? You have to have that in place. Step 8, hot site. Now, hot sites, they are, number one, they are the best, but they cost the most. In other words, it's just like a mirror image, an exact mirror image of what you have. Let's say you have a particular office, you have another office with everything in there, everything running and everything, just in case you need to go to there. So that is, it does cost a lot of money, but it is the best. Step 9, restoring systems initial state, full backup and recovery. Now, and I'm gonna mention here, it's not on this slide, but when it comes to this, the data, remember you have the business data, sales data, human resources data, all this data and all the departments have to be ready to be restored. Now you got applications. Now with applications, you know, you have operating system, backbone of applications, and then you have like software, like the different programs and stuff that runs over that. So you have to have everything listed and ready to go. Step 10, rebuilding the new data center. Step 11, regularly test and evaluation of the disaster recovery plan. This is where, once again, and I've seen this, businesses slack. It feels like they're being bothered and they don't want to look in the mirror. Step 12, physical disaster site rebuilding. And now when it comes to this step, and I'm going to say this, you can't wait till a particular infrastructure, physical office is rebuilt for you to get back to operation. You have to have something mobile and something offline ready to go kick online to continue your business continuity until you get your site back up. We all in this IT field will face this if we're not going to be leading out in disaster recovery and business continuity. We'll be working or either directly or indirectly with these departments, so we have to be aware of this. The common threats, and I mentioned some of them, cyber breach, very bad, breakdown at single point of failure. Now, that's bad too, but because it's a single point of failure, once you fix that particular point, everything goes back up, but you have to know what the points are and be ready. Next point is outage of major application or service, which is something you gotta be prepared for. Impact due to lack of appropriately trained staff. Now, this is very bad because if the staff is not trained, they're just not trained. It's going to take you longer to get back online, which means you will have to spend more money now to get a third party to come in to help get your business on track. You have to if you want to keep your business going. Unavailability of key vendor provided services. You have to be ready for this. If they're not available, you got to have another vendor ready. Regional infrastructure outage, individual component failure. This component could be staff, machinery, bad decisions, etc. You have to plan for all of this. Failure to identify and document dependencies in technology. Dependencies mean what depends on what. You have to have all of that documented ready. The summary, and I'm going to say this, and I'll just summarize it. Basically, like I mentioned, and even where I work, I see people don't want to be bothered to stop what they're doing, to have meetings regarding this, to run simulations. But the second bullet here says, once a business is struck with a disaster, they must implement the business continuity plan, and begin the disaster recovery steps outlined in the disaster recovery plan. However, if this is something they took lightly, it's going to be a long haul, and it's going to be a lot of frustration for them to get back online, of which means if they really want their business to continue, they're going to have to hire a third party, which, you know, they could do it. The third party could come in and help, which means you're going to spend money. They're going to spend the money to get this back up and going. And I'm going to read the first point, and I'm going to close. It says, the reality of success and great profits many times, and I wrote this, obscures one's vision of the possibility that at any moment, such success and profit revenue can come to an end due to risks and attacks that can happen to the business. We cannot let profits and success blind our vision when it comes to our vulnerabilities and risk. It's a human thing, but it's something we have to keep in check when it comes to dealing with business, especially critical business. Businesses that this community depends on, that people's lives depend on, that other businesses depend on. You have to cover all ends and have everything, have all the endpoints covered. Now, like, there are some things like the cloud would help on, which, like, you could have infrastructure as a service, software as a service, and all of these things. However, you still need to have a disaster recovery plan, because there will be some local infrastructure that you will have. Even if you're still leasing something through Amazon or Google or some software simulations, or you're using with them, still, you need to cover your end and work with these online cloud providers and have a disaster recovery plan. And they always tell you, you need to have one. Work with them. Have all this documented. Have your legal department ready as well, because you could be facing suits. If it's like, you got, let's say, read your fine print. If you're providing a service for somebody, and then that fine print, it says if they depend on you for critical services and you're not providing that, can you be sued? Can you face legal stuff, because people's lives depend on it? All these things you have to have covered with your legal department, human resources, accounting department, business, IT. All the departments need to quantum team. And I'm going to borrow from the Purdue with the quantum team and thing. So yeah, you need to all the departments need to quantum team when it comes to that. So that's the end of this presentation. If anyone has any questions, comments, feel free to do so. And I'll stop there.
Excellent job.
Let me see if I could stop.
And all great points that you put there too. Love it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's something that came. I came across, because I've seen this happen before. So.
Oh yeah, it's a big thing, and we've been, you know, I've had many times interns who want to do that for us here with the internship, and it hasn't been completed. There's always a start, but it hasn't been completed.
But like a disaster recovery plan?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Because we've had a disaster, and we recovered from it. But, you know, we were learning at that point, man, what do we have to do? And that's why we've come down to the point where only so many people have permissions and, you know, take care of certain things. And, you know, we have to have specific owners for things so things aren't lost. Okay. It's definitely so important for any business to have something like that. This was fantastic.
Yeah, so I'm not, like I say, I'm no expert in this, but I remember looking through these points, and I remember some businesses going down that I saw. I said, well, this is serious. I know you guys are very tech savvy. I'll know we're all, you know, learning the details, but what happens if the tech that we depend on, something goes down? And I said,
yep. And I was on vacation. Doc and I were on vacation, and all we saw was tons and tons of text messages and stuff going through. We're like, oh my God, what happened? And someone had shut down our server. It was another server before AWS, and they totally shut it down. Luckily, we had enough people who had things backed up, so we didn't lose anything.
My goodness.
But my gosh, we knew from that point on we had to do something, and that was to give permissions and to remove permissions right away.
Oh,
that was one thing for sure. Only certain people got permissions, that's for sure.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Gene. Well, that was awesome. Yeah. So what I'm going to do for this next one, I have one from Tamir Witherspoon. He couldn't be with us, of course, because he's graduated. But he did give me his presentation. So I will go ahead and... set that up for it. I just have to put it in the right window. Here, like this. And then how do I do that? I don't have enough screens. Okay, I gotta put it over here. Fine. Now let's do switch these. There we go. All right. So share. Let's try this again. Yeah, that one. Turn that on. And here we go. Can everybody see my screen?
Yes. Masterclass. Yes, management. Yeah.
Okay. Don't forget to turn off your mics, everybody. And here we go.
Hi, my name is Tamir Witherspoon, and this is my masterclass on management. Well, we're going to begin the masterclass with what is management. As we all know, management, we all should know what management is, but just in case we don't, and this is a refresher, management is the process of dealing with or controlling things or people. It is also the coordination and administration of tasks to achieve a goal. And there's also five basic operations of a manager. Setting objectives, organizing, motivating the team, devising systems of management, and developing people. In today's world, managers and management is a key feature of our business. So knowing these key basic operations will help you understand exactly where and how things go. Management styles. There are three styles of management. Persuasive management style, which is a compelling leader. A compelling leader will spend time with their team and persuade rather than instruct. There's also the democratic management style, and invites teams to be directly involved in decision making. There's an open line of the communication, which basically means that, like how the government or the country works as form of voting powers and how the people get to vote for their own representatives, team members get to be involved in decision making from a manager's point of view. And then the last one, I'm do apologize for saying the last one, but it's going to be laissez-faire management, which is the manager functions like a mentor, rather than just a normal manager. The managers empower the employees to step up and make decisions on their own. The type of managers, there are four types of managers. Top level managers, which is typically the CEOs and CFOs, middle managers, which is typically the ones that report to the top level managers. First line managers, these are managers that are in on the product floor. These are the ones that are basically they're supervising the team. They see the action firsthand. And then there's the team leads. These are the team leads are the people that report to the front line managers. And they basically make this, they assign tasks to different team members. They assign tasks to the team itself. They have basically almost become have a supervisor type role, but with a less authority. So they can't really do too much as far as making hiring decisions. The difference between a manager and a leader. There's really no major difference. They're basically the same. Managers are leaders that lead small to large teams and can often be called upon to run businesses. Basically, they're just basically the same. A leader is a manager, manager is a leader. Their function is pretty much just the same. For example, the president is a leader. He's a manager. He's managed the country. And without them, things can't really function. So the same thing works with the manager. They're just basically the same. There's no big major difference. You need a leadership skills in order to be able to run, become a manager. And a manager needs to be a leader in order to run a team. What do managers do? Managers mentor new hires and current team members. They hire new employees. They onboard new employees as well as offboard them during the termination process. Basically, when they fire an employee, they just offboard them, get them off the team, and lock their system up, make sure they get their final paychecks, etc. And they also do budgeting, marketing, and other related tasks in order to keep the business running at the same time. Their businesses is they're basically just there to be able to make sure the business functions as usual. Why are managers important? Managers are important because without them, business operations will slow and there will be no one to lead the team. Managers also do the heavy lifting of hiring new employees and onboarding them as well. So basically, managers are just as important as anything. Without them, there really will be no businesses at all. Businesses are not typically run by employees. Managers are hired for a reason. Managers are hired because of their skills. They're hired because of their style of management and their education. So having a manager is much as important as having employees. Most managers are business owners, and owners are managers, and managers are owners. And sometimes owners hire managers to be able to run the business when they're not available to do it themselves. Who can manage? Basically, anyone. Anyone can manage. If you have the skills that are the skills and you meet the minimum requirements, then you basically become a manager. As long as you go and get your education, have the experience and everything, you basically become a manager. And there's no really set requirement, even though it's known for managers to have at least 5 or 10 years of experience on a specific job or operate their own business at the same time. They're known for that. It's just that anyone can become a manager. There's no minimum requirement to become. There's no set age or no, like, you have to be someone has 100 years of experience, anything like that. You could basically anyone can become a manager. Education requirements for managers. Basically, these are two. The minimums have a high school diploma, but then the higher ones are attain a bachelor's degree in business management. This will allow you to gain the skills of marketing as well as strategic thinking. And the next step is you can also obtain a master's degree in business administration or a master in marketing. These degrees, you can stop at the bachelor's degree, but it's also good to have a master's in these other, a master's in the others due to because at the end of the day, you are still running a business and you need to be able to know how to run that business. Yes, experience is necessary, but at the same time, having the education to be able to know how the market and how the business world is changing and knowing how to handle that in certain situations, it's best to get through, the master's and bachelor's degrees. Yes, you'll have to spend a lot more time in school, probably spend a little bit more, but at least you'll have that education behind you and it looks good on a resume as well. Are you a team leader or supervisor? You can be either or. If you meet the minimum requirements. In order to be a supervisor, you have to become a team leader for at least one year or more years. This will allow you to gain the experience in leading a team. If you do this, you basically become a supervisor. And then you can at least start with the team lead and then work your way up to be a supervisor. And once you become a supervisor, you can be a top line manager. Basically like a hiring manager or a director or anything that oversees everyone else. You can be either or. Long as you have the know-how and the willpower to do it, you can. The difference in managers and supervisors, there's no major difference. Supervisors typically are considered the lower level managers with almost the same authority based on the company designs and how it is structured. Basically, that's exactly what it is. Managers or supervisor managers, and it just really depends on the business structure. They have all the same authorities as anyone else, no matter what. Sometimes most jobs will have just straight supervisors. They still have this capability to be able to hire you and fire you, as well as issue a paycheck if need be. So basically, there's no really major difference in either or. See yourself getting a promotion. The best way is becoming a manager is a hard task to do, but if you set your mind to it, then you can get the promotion you always wanted. Gain the experience, at least 5 years to be exact. Work connections within the business and show that you are able to make the big leap. Basically, just work hard. Show how you can become that manager, how you become the manager. Just work hard, work those connections, show that you're capable of being able to do it. Without that, you won't become a manager at all. Lead the team. Your team is the most important thing, and it is the reason you have the job. Mentor all members of your team and take note of all their concerns. Show the team that you care for them and want to make sure their needs are met. Basically, you need your team, and your team needs you. You can't lead your team, then you can't become a manager. That's the bottom line. If you can't do that, then there's no point in becoming a manager at all. Managers need to lead their team. Teams are the most important thing for them. Be ethical. Ethics in management is a key to everything. Without a business, will basically become corrupt, and you just won't be able to run it all. As a manager, you only promote who you think deserve it. Don't just hand out promotions because you want to. Promote who you think are deserve it, and don't hire family because you owe them a favor or you need a favor. And don't take favors at all. For promotion, just don't. The ethics is make sure you follow the rules and do your job correctly. Don't do favors, don't hire family, and don't throw out promotions like it's candy. And some of the key questions are: Are you able to do the job? Yeah, are you able to do the job? Now that being a manager is not built for everybody. Are you able to do the job? Do you meet the requirements? Do your resume and education and everything matches up? Do they match it up? If they match up, then you can apply to that manager job. And like I said before, in the first question, is becoming a manager meant for everyone? It's not. Becoming a manager is not meant for everyone. Some people get a job, become a manager, and all of a sudden they get the job, and it only lasts a couple months because it becomes hard. You have to make tough decisions. You got to be able to be up and write up, talk to your team, fire people when you don't need to fire when time comes. It's not really meant for everyone. It's not built for everyone. Most people are just not ready to become a manager, and some people are. You got to think of that at the long term. But other than that, I think at the end of the day, you can become a manager if you set your mind to it. This way, managers are capable of doing extraordinary things, and I think you can. And as of right now, I think I'm on a road to become a manager myself, and I want to. And I hope whoever's listening to this masterclass will do the exact same. And I thank you for listening to my masterclass on management. And if you have any questions, you're more than welcome to ask anybody in your internship or anything like that. But please do ask questions and please do try to work hard. And thank you for listening.
Well, I hope Tamir watches this. He's done a great job. That's for sure. That was excellent. That was a lot of information that was needed. Absolutely. I'll tell you. It takes a certain kind of people who can be good managers, you know. That's why we don't use managers per se in the internship. We use leads because manager just kind of doesn't work so well with us. I think it's more just kind of leading. We're directing people in the direction they should go. You know, you're leading them. Managing is you don't really manage them. You just help. So who do we have next? Yvette, are you ready?
You darn tootin', I'm ready. I am ready, ready, ready. All right. Let me share my screen.
Oh, cutie patootie.
She always looked at me like I was a dork when I was taking her picture, especially while she was sleeping. Every once in a while, she'd wake up and look at me like that.
It
wouldn't stop me, though. Right.
All right.
Well, hello, everybody. Can you see everything all right?
Good night. Yes.
Yes. Awesome.
Thank you. I am so happy for this opportunity and honor to spend this Friday Eve with my awesomely awesome Quantum team. Thank you so much for taking time away from your busy schedules to hang out with me for a little bit tonight. For those who received my previous announcements where I said I would be using the Prezi software, I'd like to apologize for the inconvenience. But after previewing the VisMe software, I decided to present with VisMe rather than Prezi. And you are about to see why. So let's begin. Welcome to my masterclass presentation on how to be better prepared for your Master of Information Technology virtual internship with Purdue. In honor of Doc, I'm leaving this masterclass presentation as my legacy for the new PGIP Padawans that are coming into the PGIP program. And just in case there are not any Star Wars or Mandalorian fans out there, a Padawan is a young Jedi. Okay, and that's what you are, some of you. Some of you are Jedi Masters, and I welcome you. Thank you. So in this masterclass, we will explore the essential tools, techniques, and strategies that will help you excel in your PGIP internship. We will cover multiple tools and platforms and frameworks that we use for your project management, communication, collaboration, and decision-making, including a reminder to maintain a healthy work, school, intern life balance while you venture on this new adventure. Let's get started. This will be our agenda for this masterclass presentation. Please take a moment to review it and take a screenshot for your notes, which reminds me, I want to put some stuff in the chat for you guys, if it'll let me. Just a moment, apologies. In the screenshot, you see I put some Jedi shortcuts in there for you, just in case you need them while we're doing notes. I put in there screenshot shortcuts for Windows and Mac, along with the link for the software that we'll be using. and my LinkedIn account. Back to business. Effective time management is crucial in an intensive virtual internship program like PGIP. You will use project management tools like MS Planner to keep track of the tasks that you are assigned to do by your internship department. You will communicate, manage your calendars, prioritize tasks, and set deadlines through programs like MS Outlook. You are giving all the tools that you need to help you allocate and master your time effectively and efficiently. A PGIP Jedi always remembers to break down complex projects into smaller tasks and create a schedule to ensure timely completion. Regularly review and adjust your schedule to accommodate for important deadlines, changing priorities, and overlapping calendars to best accommodate for multitasking between tasks, learning assignments, learning labs, tutorials, weekly AAHOD meetings, weekly internship department meetings, weekly masterclass meetings, and dependent on your Jedi level of PGIP that you're aiming for, you might have other meetings as well. The more you plan and prepare, the more successful you will be, and the more fulfilled and happier you will be throughout your time with the internship and your career. Plan to have fun, learn a lot, and be sure to make some awesome connections with your quantum team. Take this time to learn everything you possibly can that can bring you knowledge and or joy in any way, shape, or form. Never learned programming languages before? Do it now. Take everything and anything that your heart desires. Now is the time. Learn it now when you're surrounded by Jedi Masters. Never supervised, managed, or led a project or team before? Do it now. As soon as you have things under control as a new Padawan, around like week two or three, ask for some leadership roles to help your quantum team and the new Padawans coming in. You will learn in weeks what people struggle to learn in months or years. You have a safety net here. Climb to new heights with the knowledge that your quantum team is here to catch you if you fall, to support you when you get back up, and to encourage you to succeed. These skills will help you with your internship and your career. Take the time needed to ensure your journey will be smooth sailing. If you do not prepare now, you will miss out on this valuable opportunity to help yourself expand your horizons. And that will leave a bitter taste of regret that will last long past your internship if you let these diamonds, as Doc calls them, slip through your fingers. If you're sitting here right now not knowing which field that you should focus on, take a few assessment tests to better gauge where your Jedi skills lie. The Force is different with everyone. I have included a link for a reputable free 15-minute career test based on the Holland Code and the Big Five systems to help you find a career or passion that will bring you joy and fulfillment. Now let's talk about getting set up for your internship quest in the next slide. Watch all of the orientation videos. I know they'll say it a lot, but they don't say it enough. You have to watch those videos. Don't miss any of them. They are offered through the PGIP internship, and they are literally all the tutorials and videos on how to do everything that you need to harness and wield the Force during your internship. Special Jedi tip, you will save much more time and heartache by taking the time now to watch all of the tutorials. Many of them are so awesome, you're going to bookmark them. And you will not need me to tell you which ones you need to bookmark into your favorites. Based on my experience as an intern in my 12th week of this internship, the following steps are your first priorities as a PGIP Padawan. Watching and reading all of the internship orientation videos and tutorials. Registering for your multi-factor authentication. Installing and downloading the My Apps extension on your browser. Installing and downloading the Time Clock Wizard. Try to do this on day one. This is a priority, so that way you can leave yourself time to resolve any issues if they occur. And if they do occur, submit a ticket immediately. Create an internship folder within the bookmarks bar of your browser, and activating accounts for any programs that you'll be using during your internship. And in the next slide, we will cover what you will have to have in your bookmarks so that everything is ready for you when you are in Padawan. Create a bookmark folder with a basic title like PGIP internship. Within the bookmark, save the links for the phone. At the top of the bookmark folder, save the link for the time clock wizard. Using multiple devices while saving the universe. The mobile device might also be helpful, so be sure to download that onto your phone. And be sure to save apps like Time Clock Wizard, Outlook, Planner on your phone and iPad. Just in case while you're on the road and fighting evil and preserving justice when a meeting hits. Then bookmark the link for submitting your tickets to your help desk. Under the Time Clock Wizard, create a subfolder called New Intern Tools. You will review and save the SharePoint links that you will be sent to prepare for your internship in here. I kept all of my tutorials, documents, and training in here so I could easily refer to them later. Create another subfolder called PGIP Intern Daily Tools. If you're not using the desktop versions of the program you are using, it is helpful to save the links for the web version here. Make sure to save the link for submitting tickets to IT so you're not hunting for them when time is scarce. Create another subfolder for your specific internship group. In my case, I had two. My first one, soft dev, and my other for the data analytics group. Next, create a learning assignment subfolder from the main folder or from your newly created internship group folder. Save each learning project program as its own subfolder. Then you're going to create a bucket list subfolder where you'll have all of your topics, languages, skills that make your heart skip a beat or make you crave to learn more information about it. Whether you want to research quickly now or delve into it more later, save it here. You will be thankful later. If you come across anything that evokes your passions, your curiosity, or your joy, record that moment in time. You may not know how it fits into your life right now, but if you listen to your gut and your heart and you get that feeling, your spidey senses tingling, telling you that this might be something that you're interested in, save it. It might surprise you later when all your puzzle pieces of life fall into place. In your new intern's tools, bookmarks, subfolder, save the links to the following items. Your helpful tutorial links. It's a SharePoint. I provided the link here. You will reference this link often in your first weeks, so keep it handy. Step 2, Orientation 1. Step 3, Orientation 2 in your PGIP Tech Intern Acknowledgement. Step 4, fit all of the apps that are used throughout your internship. Now let's see what kind of apps we'll be bookmarking for the internship in the next slide. Efficient project execution is crucial in the PGIP internship. With multiple tasks, lessons, projects, you must utilize project management tools such as Microsoft Planner and Time Clock Wizard to organize your tasks, track progress, manage schedules, and ensure accountability. These tools will help you stay organized and meet deadlines and collaborate effectively with all of your stakeholders. In your PGIP Intern Daily Tools bookmarks folder, you will want to save the links to the following items. MS Outlook, MS Teams, your particular PGIP department's intern folders. This information will be provided to you. This is the template for the AHOD presentation that you have to create each week is in this folder. Always leave the original AHOD template alone and create a copy. There's a button for that to create your new weekly presentation and then use the naming convention as follows. It's due weekly on Sunday at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. And just in case you have issues with the time clock wizard, be kind to all of your managing team leads. And if you have screenshots that must be shared, save them into individual folders by date so your team leads don't have to hunt around and they know exactly which folders you're referring to. Your department's intern portal, a planner portal, is where you'll get your the Padawan portal where you'll be informed of your Jedi quest. The weekly status report is a dynamic form that's filled out every week and submitted on Tuesdays at 11:59. Make sure before you submit to check the box to send a copy to your email. I found that very helpful on multiple occasions. Make sure to save a copy of your PDF for your academic internship professor and your team lead in your internship group. Some JEDI tips. You may enter information in it and it will auto-save until you submit it. Also, be sure to save your meeting notes in something like OneNote, separated by date and subject. Now let's see how a JEDI prepares for their week in the following slides. But first, some pearls of wisdom from a JEDI master. Be sure not to put off any of your tasks, assignment, projects, or communications. It's also important not to put off any exploring of your passions and interests. Now is the time. This is your grown-up playground, and it's recess time, so let's play. While never, ever ignoring what needs to be done, it does not make your obligations go away. When you do, it only creates roadblocks on your path to a better future, for a more fulfilled life for yourself and your loved ones. Please remember the four P's of PGIP success, JEDI success. Prepare, plan, participate, persist. That is what makes PGIP success. Nearly all of what our job and internship requires depends on our ability to pay attention to meetings. Throughout the PGIP internship, you will have multiple meetings per week. Always take good notes and screenshots when appropriate or necessary. Put all the meetings in your Outlook calendar immediately if you're not provided with a calendar meeting invite. Let's delve a little deeper with the next slide. In your Outlook calendar, add a calendar entry for each week of the internship now. You'll be so thankful that you did later when time is scarce and your brain is completely fried. Add a subject like internship week one. Color code it with any color other than red because you want to save red for high priorities. Some JEDI tips. The start date will always be a Wednesday. The end date on your forms will always be the following Tuesday. Save these dates to enter into your weekly status report. See, I told you you'd be thankful. Leave the appointment as the show as category of free. Check the all day event box. In your Outlook calendar, confirm, add mandatory weekly Tuesday AHOD meetings to your calendar. As of the date of this presentation, the AHOD meetings are held every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Confirm, add the mandatory weekly Monday departmental meeting or whichever day that your departmental meeting falls. As of the date of the presentation, my departmental analytics BD meetings were held on Monday at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Create a PGIP internship folder in your secure cloud of choice or in a prominently safe folder on your computer. Cloud is better for JEDIs and Padawans traveling the universe that cannot be strapped to a desk. Save a copy of anything that you create or complete on your own cloud platforms, as anything you save in specific internship folders and drives will disappear from the force once you officially become a PGIP JEDI. In your PGIP internship folder, create the following subfolders. Weekly status report. Weekly AHOD slides. Label with the same naming convention as the AHOD slide title from your internship department's intern folders on OneDraw. Weekly detailed timesheets. Masterclass presentations. Undergrad students have one. Grad students have two. Create subfolders for each presentation so you can keep your references, materials, images, etc. for each one in a place of easy reference. Subfolders for each learning project slash task to keep important materials such as certificates, badges, trophies earned, user guides for programs being learned, relevant ebooks, PDFs, and articles. At the end of your shift, after you have clocked out of the time clock wizard, if you have a Mac, your computer may appear to freeze temporarily as it becomes one with the force again. If this happens, locate the time clock wizard icon at the taskbar at the top of your main menu. You still see it there? You got to right click. and then quit. After you do, it will shut down without any issue and you will be one with the Force again. So, my dear Padawans, listen to the echoes of the Force resonating within your very being. Trust in the Force within you, young Padawan, for it holds the power to guide your journey. You all possess limitless potential, like brilliant stars gleaming in the vast galaxy. Remember to embrace your courage in the face of adversity, for it is through challenges that true growth emerges. Never forget to believe in your abilities, for the Force flows through every fiber of your being. Together, we shall illuminate the path to greatness, for within you lies the power to shape destinies and bring balance to the galaxy. Welcome and embrace challenges as opportunities. Wield your knowledge as your lightsaber, young Padawan, and let your resilience and strength be your ally. Remember, a Jedi's strength lies not only in their skills, but also in their unwavering belief in their own potential. Embrace challenges as opportunities. Wield knowledge as your lightsaber and let your resilience be your ally. Thank you so much. May the Force be with you and your path to greatness guide you on this extraordinary journey of discovery and purpose, my young Jedi. And these are my references. Thank you so much. Sorry I lost it there. I'm just so thankful to be here with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Yvette. That was excellent. I loved it.
I'm so glad.
Great.
Wow. Great.
Yes. Straight from the heart. You're so sweet.
I wanted to be straight from the heart.
Yes. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, that was great. And I think I might have you do something for me before you leave. So.
Okay.
We were talking about it here in the background. So, but that was really good and very helpful. So perfect. I loved it.
Thank you.
Great job.
Can I have a copy of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll have it, right?
Absolutely.
Definitely. I would love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
For the new interns, that would be wonderful.
Oh, yes, exactly. That was my thought.
That would have helped me when I saw it.
Exactly. Okay, Reese, you are next if you're ready.
Awesome. Can you hear me? Hello?
I can, yes.
Awesome. All right. See how this... Sorry, I've never done this before. Can you guys see that?
I see I see it now. Absolutely.
Okay. Perfect. Awesome. Perfect. All right. So my presentation is how automation and AI are affecting the software industry. I'm sure a lot of you guys hear about AI all the time. It's all in the news. It's taking everything over, right? So I figure I'd make a presentation on that. Today's agenda. I'm going to be looking at how AI helps streamline the coding process. Examples of AI integrated IDEs, tasks that have become completely automated thanks to AI, industry projections and how it affects jobs and things of that nature, and new possibilities thanks to AI. So starting here, effects on the coding process. As many of you have seen while using IDEs such as Visual Studio's its IntelliSense, you'll often be prompted with autocomplete suggestions from the program for your syntax to finish the lines you're currently writing, and in some cases do much more than that. However, a fairly new feature that you may be seeing in some IDEs is the ability to type plain language into a program and have code spit back out just as fast as you could provide the prompt. This is an example of natural language being converted into code. Certain programs and AI are working to do this, and they're getting better day by day. This code is generated based off of machine learning used on a multitude of open source projects to teach the machines what users are asking for. So basically what that means is it analyzes all the code that people leave out in the open and the sources, and then takes descriptions of that code and it pushes them together in order to understand what the words mean as compared to the code and the syntax. Though many of these programs are only good for simple tasks and frequently produce buggy programs, when given large tasks, they improve every day and provide functionality that eliminates much of the legwork associated with programming. I know when I use IntelliSense and doing C#, if I have repetitive lines, C# auto-completes for you. That's something that's been around, that's before AI. But with the AI-integrated IDEs, it'll even predict what your next lines will be, even if they aren't repetitive, which is pretty impressive. Some examples of those are the OpenAI Codex, the program based on chat on GPT-3, and this is a backbone for GitHub Copilot. I don't know if any of you guys used GitHub Copilot. It's pretty well integrated. It's not something I have a whole lot of experience with, but it is pretty impressive. Tab 9 is a type of assistant, and it supports most popular language. I think it supports 16 languages, all the way from C to Python and Java. That one is pretty in-depth. And that one is kind of gives suggestions more than fixes stuff for you. It's like a helper on the side, and it's pretty good when you have lots of people coding different things. It'll look at it all and kind of make sure you're all coding in the same type of, not necessarily style, but without stepping on each other's toes. Code T5 is, it'll take natural text and turn it to code. And it'll also take code and summarize it and give it to you in natural language, which is something that I found super valuable when it comes to learning code, is being able to find the reverse, looking at the code first and then putting it in there and then having it tell me what it does and comparing what I thought it was doing compared to what it actually is doing. Program this AI takes written language and can perform SQL series. So that's getting more out of the programming languages and more into the simple query language. And that one is super useful for database work, because you can just put stuff in natural language and it'll guide you in the right direction. Automation and tasks done by AI. A lot of resource management, especially at Amazon, is almost completely managed by AI. It can look at what usage you've been using and change where it's allocating resources for your, say, your cloud computing, things like that. Social media, a lot of businesses make posts and outreach using AI. I'm sure you've seen it if you've tried getting in touch with your insurance. They'll use a chatbot type AI to whittle it down to which section you need to talk to a representative if you need to at all. Sometimes AI can take care of that entirely. Finance, this is actually a pretty big one. There are some financial AI bots out there that you can pay to use their service, and they'll read market trends for you, and you can set analytic points for them to monitor for you and give you suggestions based off of what they see. And then search engines. I mean, Google has their BERT or their BART that they're working on, and even ChatGPT itself is becoming its own type of search engine, as you can ask it so many questions and it will search the internet and give it to you in plain language rather than multiple sources. Industry projections. A lot of people, when AI started flooding the market and becoming more available, were worried that jobs in the software field may become more scarce, as you don't need as many coders if people can type it in plain language and it'll make the code. This actually isn't true at all. Most statistics point towards software development and computer science fields to be opening up actually by 25% for soft dev and 35% for computer science, as you're going to need more people to integrate and make breakthroughs using that AI, as well as develop more on top. New possibilities. When it comes to AI, it's opened the door for many, many new things, and it's made a lot of things a lot more efficient. Currently, they have AI trying to planned city structure in order to create cities that reduce traffic and also are safer to move through, such as reducing the number of places where crime is usually seen in cities and making those almost non-existent, as well as AI and healthcare. As of right now, I mean, can't think of many people that would trust a totally autonomous thing to take care of their health. But as we move forward, that is something they're working towards, especially towards the online diagnosis thing that's become bigger, and they're trying to integrate AI into that so people can only visit in person when they absolutely have to and get with a certified technician where it's needed. Because as many of you probably seen during the COVID epidemic, hospitals were flooded with people who were more scared than they were sick, and it caused for problems with the people who actually needed help as there was no resources available to them. So AI is just another thing that could be used at our disposal when it comes to healthcare. And are there any questions? I know I went a little fast, but I did not plan on this staying this late, and I do have work to go to tonight. So,
excellent. Great job. A lot of information about AI I had not really thought about. But
oh,
it's
yeah.
all new to me.
We're
anyways,
definitely doing the healthcare.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, I'm doing that. So, yes, we are.
That's awesome. All right. Oh. Stop sharing here. Well, thank you, everybody. What's that?
Yeah, when it comes to the, I had a question about that. The AI, I know the time is running, but it's something, because I watched Arnold Schwarzenegger growing up, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I like, my cousin don't like Arnold, my female's cousin, but I love Arnold. I'm an Arnold fan. And I saw it's Terminator, the AI. Two things. Do you think in the future, and I'm not saying this is going to be like a human or a think or whatever human is, we don't really know fully anyway, but the current AI, they're running on some very powerful, which AI are you referring to that's not going to like affect jobs? Are you referring to AI that you could put on like a public computer that people could easily get their hands on, or more like exclusive powerful mainframes, or like quantum machines?
So I wouldn't say that AI won't affect jobs. It's going to affect jobs greatly. It's just as far as projected number of jobs, it should, and as it relates to the tech field, it's projected to actually increase the number of available job opportunities rather than decrease it, which was the common notion for most people when AI first started being rolled out and becoming more of a mainstream thing. They thought that companies were going to use these AIs to automate the work of many of their tech employees, which is not the case, because they still need the people in order to run the AI. And obviously something that they are worried about, like it's called the singularity, right? You give the AI too much power and it makes a decision that like the Terminator. So that's something that they're actually developing rules for and limits on AI. Like currently, a lot of the bigger AI engines, such as ChatGPT and things like that, are only being fed information from 2021 and back in order to make sure that it can't be caught up with everybody.
Okay. Well, that's for people who follow the rules, though.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously yeah, there could be rogues.
I'm sorry. You were saying?
Yeah, like you said, obviously, if there are people who want to use it for malicious intent, it's the same as anything, right? It's,
that's true.
The police have guns and then criminals have guns, right?
Yes. But let me ask you a question, Reed. What do you think about, like, I know the more powerful computers, because I took a class when it came to cryptography. I remember the professor, very great professor. The one threat they mentioned is like when quantum machines come out, those right. machines, what the most powerful machines can't break today, they said quantum machines will be able to do it easily. So what if you put like an artificial intelligence on the platform of a quantum machine what would happen, since you know more about this than I do.
I mean, definitely when it comes to higher level computing, I'm not an expert. I just assume that would make it a lot more efficient, a lot faster, and it would allow it to evolve if it had that capability at a rate that we haven't seen yet, because we're obviously limited by hardware. But there are some of those really fast computers. I don't know if they have AI running in them. I know the furthest I've seen is that I think it was Facebook had two separate AIs, and it put them together to see how they would evolve together. And they actually ended up creating their own language that wasn't human readable. Like,
really?
It was only machine to machine, and they couldn't decipher it. So they actually had to shut those bots completely down. Yeah.
Don't you think that's a threat, Reese?
That's why they shut them down. They don't know where that's going to go. And I mean, I'm not creating any AI. I'm an associate's candidate right now. So I promise you, I'm not doing that stuff. But yeah, it is definitely something to be wary of and something we should keep an eye on.
Thank you. Wow. I'm sorry for the questions.
No worries. This is what the slide is for. I appreciate it.
And a little scary to me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, really. Thank you for that information. That's awesome. Very good job. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Arian, I guess you are it.
Yes, ma'am. Hello, everyone. Good evening.
Hello.
All right. Let me get going here. All right. Can everyone see my presentation?
Yes, we can. Yep.
All right. So this evening, I'll be doing my presentation over technology and how it impacts education. I picked this topic because science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM topics, has always been an area where I have struggled to learn and excel. Even though I've struggled, the tools that make STEM projects more enjoyable have always interested me. For example, Big Brain Academy, played on the Nintendo DS, is an educational video game focused on learning. It prepares kids to grasp, retain, and perform better in all areas of life where the brain is at work. This game improves math, memory, logical, and reasoning abilities of the players. I also enjoy playing VR games. I've had several VR experiences that elevate the excitement and determination in completing missions or tasks. For example, the PlayStation VR has several puzzle games. One in particular that I like to play is called Tumble VR. It's basically a brain teaser puzzle game where you solve puzzles with blocks shapes, and it's really immersive, and it encourages you to continue to focus and level up and find solutions to the puzzles. Virtual reality headsets and video games enhance learning outcomes. So how does VR technology do this? Well, it starts with visualizing abstract concepts. For example, visualizing 3D objects, tracking signals as they pass through your nervous system, or visualizing bridges and how adding weight or traffic, cars, impacts the structure. Another way is exploring scenarios that are difficult or dangerous to recreate in the classroom, such as science lab experiments involving chemicals that are explosive, for instance, or monitoring the heart's activity during a stroke or a heart attack, something that you cannot see with your eyes. Another use is enabling students with special needs to experiment with different learning strategies. Students with attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, and dyslexia may learn more using virtual concepts and experimentation. Augmented reality is also used to assist students with expanding their vocabulary, for instance. Textbooks are created with audio recordings, video clips, and 3D images to explain text. How do computer-based video games enhance learning? The Oregon Trail is an educational strategy video game first released in 1985. Along the trail, players make choices about supplies, resource management, and the route that they take through the game. Another game that's really important right now, especially with curriculum learning, is called Adventure Academy. It focuses on reading comprehension, vocabulary development, mathematical operations, and geography. How does technology improve skills? The popularity of video games has transferred to the classroom as more educators use the technology and experience positive outcomes with their students. Research has also found that not only children play video games, but adults do too, but we don't need research for that. Can video games be instructional? Well, yeah, they can. They can change the attitudes about learning, promote decision making, be used to supplement teaching, and encourage the learner's involvement. They also improve basic developmental skills and mathematical skills. Basic developmental skills are enhanced by using visual game patterns or by the speed of games, or even by following the story of a game. Basic mathematics skills are strengthened with mathematical games and even with the interaction of counters in games or even scoring in games. The social aspect. Games build a common interest among children. The interaction around this common interest encourages positive communication, collaboration, and goal setting. The social benefits of gaming are clear. This technology connects students who are feeling socially deprived, especially like during the pandemic, for instance. It allows them to connect with friends online and find common interests with their own families. Gaming is a social space for many. The majority of gamers play by themselves or play with friends online. They also play with parents or guardians, siblings. Over 50% of kids aged 12 to 15 and 46% of 8 to 11 year olds also talk with friends online or do some sort of social interaction. Video games and engagement. Advancements in video games are creating a more immersive learning environment for students, especially with science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Video game technology is manipulated by the user on various devices, such as cell phones, computers, game consoles, virtual reality headsets, augmented reality headsets. One of the most important aspects of video games and positive development of the brain is the competitive nature of action games. In action games especially, large amounts of focus and fast-paced game environments train your brain to become more flexible and handling complex tasks. In studies, visual perception and spatial abilities were strengthened by the use of action video games. To the left here, we have Avanti's World. It's an educational virtual reality theme park. In this highly immersive environment, players can travel to the moon, float through blood vessels, stand in the middle of a volcano and watch it erupt, and learn about the processes and how those things work in that virtual environment. To the right, Mission ISS Quest is a space simulation VR game that's also highly immersive. And players of this game operate things in space. So they operate robotic arms, they do spacewalks, they travel to different planets, and even do tours of satellites. STEM. So STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Job positions are in high demand in these fields. For the nation to be in the forefront of science and technology, we must develop a STEM education approach that prepares students for the future. STEM areas will direct new technologies and innovations across many fields. To encourage students and increase interest in STEM topics, video games can play a valuable part in that. Game engineers and educators are looking for ways to make STEM topics more desirable amongst children. STEM digital game-based learning uses video games to help learners visualize scientific concepts. Video games help users feel excitement in game activities, which promotes problem-solving skills and longer gameplay. While playing any video game, there is a period of time spent learning the mechanics and the rules of the game. During this time, players are allowed to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes without facing harsh criticisms. The future of technology and learning. Due to COVID, the pandemic, educational technology is booming. Many students are experiencing digital platforms such as Microsoft Teams, Zoom, Google Classroom. Teams allows users to speak and see each other using video calls or make presentations, present things. Although using Teams does not replace real-world interactions, it has become the next best method of learning during this time. Constant research is being explored in the realm of EdTech. EdTech implements various technologies such as Blackboard and Google Classroom to bring learning into the digital world. The shift from traditional learning styles to innovative styles is paramount to the future of education. E-learning is being used to keep students and teachers in close contact with each other through their learning processes. Through the ongoing development of e-learning, students can take tests online, interact on message boards, and have live discussions with their teachers. Learning video games can also be a tool built into e-learning. In this medium, students can watch videos in a platform and take a quiz on that content without leaving their computer or smartphones. Training students to learn electronically is becoming easier due to the rapid innovation of accessible educational content and the hardware that supports it. To wrap it up, every day new frontiers of learning are realized. COVID-19 thrusted the world into becoming pioneers of the digital learning space. Further advancements in the development of video games and virtual reality continue to be explored. Positive learning attributes of many types of video games and VR experiences continue to be developed and used in the classroom. Educators continue to push the boundaries with acceptable ways to teach their students, especially in the fields of STEM. Digital access makes it possible for students to apply their solutions to real-world problems with authentic audiences well beyond the boundaries of their schools. The potential of technology is to enable students to use their knowledge in the world. Thank you guys for listening, and I look forward to questions or comments. Thank you.
Wow, excellent job. You guys are doing so good. That was great, Arian.
Thank you.
Awesome. Any questions for any of our presenters this evening? You all did such a wonderful job. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. You all did an excellent job. You definitely will. You have earned your grade in that. And, you know, I'm trying to make sure that the instructors go to PGI Pods and watch your presentations. Let them know. Tell them, you know, you did present your masterclass and this is something that they wanted. So they need to watch it. So thank you, everybody. And have a great rest of your evening.
Excellent job, all.
Thank you. See you guys later.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Hate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.